From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Jihan Sadat, the widow of slain Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. Her autobiography chronicles her life at the center of Middle Eastern politics and her efforts to gain equality for Muslim women. Also today, I talk with soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. The soprano was associated with traditional jazz until Lacy brought it into a modern setting. He's an American expatriate who's returned to New York for a short concert tour. Singer Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne stop by to do one of their original songs, and humorist Al Gingold explains why you don't really know someone till you've been through their record collection. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Jihan Sadat, the widow of slain Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. She's a tireless campaigner for women's rights, which places her at odds with the rising tide of Islamic fundamentalism. When her husband issued decrees granting wives the right to sue for divorce if their husbands engaged in polygamy, the laws were informally known as Jihan's laws in recognition of her efforts. Jihan Sadat was married when she was 15, Anwar Sadat was 29, and had just been released from prison for his role in attempting to end the British occupation of Egypt. As her husband devoted more of his time to politics, Jihan Sadat returned to school, earning bachelor, master's, and doctorate degrees from Cairo University in Arabic literature. A few years after Anwar Sadat's death in 1981, she began lecturing at American universities. She now divides her time between homes in Virginia and Egypt. Jihan Sadat has written an autobiography. It's titled A Woman of Egypt, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I think you were 19 when you had your first baby.
Yes.
And just a few days after that, your husband was in President Nasser's administration. And just a few days after your first child was born, an assassination attempt was made on President Nasser's life. And I was thinking that you were probably worried about assassination attempts on your husband ever since that moment.
Yes, that's true. And there were many attempts to assassinate him as one of the revolutionists, as one who was in the court having a trial for the communists in the country and the fundamentalists. And he was attempted and we were threatened several times. Most of our life, really, since the revolution started, we were threatened and we were receiving letters, even calls at home.
You say that your husband's attitude toward possible assassination could be summed up with this quote from the Quran: wherever you may be, death shall overtake you, even though you be in fortified castles. And your husband said, when my time comes,
exactly,
it will come. Was he just saying that to reassure you, or do you think he really had that attitude?
Well, he wanted, I'll tell you a very short story. When I was young and the beginning of the revolution, I was asleep at night, and he was always coming at home very late at night, sometimes in the morning. They were very busy having meetings all the time with the former Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president at that time, and the other revolutionists. One day I heard, while I was sleeping, bullets. And then I waked up. Our home, we were living, looking over the Nile. And I thought the first moment that someone, my husband was coming and someone shot him. And I thought, why don't I go down? I was living on the fifth floor. I thought, why don't I go running and bringing him and taking him to a hospital to save his life? And then I said, what about the people, the guards, which are standing in front of the home of the house which I live in, the fifth floor? What are they going to say at 2 o'clock in the morning? The wife of Sadat is going in the street. I said, no, better not. And then I thought, why? Why do I leave my husband bleeding and then don't go and save him? Let me go. No, I will not pay attention to what they are going to say. Anyhow, I was torn between going down and staying, going and staying. And then it passed so few minutes till I found the key in the door and my husband came. And I looked at him. I found him not wounded, nothing happened to him. And then I cried. And he was very surprised. He told me, what's wrong with you, Jan? I said, well, I thought you were shot. I heard bullets and I thought you were shot. He said, listen, if you live in this worry, your life will be very hard life. And you can never add any moment, even if I was shot and you went to trying to save me, you will not save me if that was the end of my life. Don't you believe in God? I said, sure, I believe. Don't you believe in faith? I said, yes, I believe. He said, then you will never add anything. When it comes, it will come. And what you read from the Quran, he told me about it. And since that time, I tried, although I was too young, I tried to convince myself with it so that I will not be always worried about him. But even though as a human being, of course, I was worried.
Well, when you were younger, you asked him to train you in how to use a gun.
Yes.
What kind of scenes did you have in your mind that you expected to use the gun for?
I thought, you know, the weekend we used to just, which is our Friday, our holiday, we used to go with our car, just sightseeing, going to places where out of the city to calm places with trees in the desert. I thought maybe someone will kill him, will shoot him. What am I going to do? Just to watch him bleeding or dying in front of me and doing nothing? First of all, I taught myself how to drive. And since that time, I drive the car alone. And then I asked him to let me know how to shoot so that I can, shoot who is going to shoot my husband. And then he took me to the desert to try to teach me how to shoot, but it was very difficult.
You gave it up?
Oh, yes.
Did he carry a gun?
Always. A pistol, not a gun. A rifle, as you say.
You had a really difficult decision to make when an editor of one of the newspapers came to you. This was in the 1970s, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he came to you and said that your husband shouldn't go to the radio or TV station because the Minister of Defense was ready to arrest him.
Yes.
If he showed up there and tried to overthrow him.
Mm-hmm.
But the editor said to you, but you cannot tell him. Prevent him from going, but you cannot tell him.
He told me at that time, promise not to tell him this because it is something that I get to know it very secretly. Then if they will know, maybe their reaction will be worse. But please be sure that he will not go to the television building. And I couldn't tell my husband because I promised him. And I couldn't keep myself without protecting my husband also on the other hand. And because of that, I told the man who was responsible for his security that please don't let him go to the television because otherwise I heard that they will arrest him. Be sure that all the guards will take care of him and protect him. It is a very dangerous time. And I just warned him with what will happen if he goes there.
Did you ever feel that you, to protect your husband, would betray the confidence of the newspaper editor who told you? I think it's something that no one who hasn't been in your position could really tell for sure what they would do if they were entrusted with a confidence like that.
I was torn. I was torn between that I promised something not to say. And on the other hand, as I said, as I told you now, I told the security man who is responsible for him to be sure about all these things.
My guest is Jihan Sadat, who, by the way, has written an autobiography, and it's titled A Woman of Egypt. You were an eyewitness to your husband's assassination.
Yes.
And you were with your grandchildren.
Yes.
But you were helpless to do anything. You couldn't even run to him. The guards prevented you from doing that. Did you wish you weren't there? It gave you the ability to be in some kind of physical proximity to him, but you were so helpless to do anything.
I was really, but when I think about the last smile he looked at me and to my grandchildren, that was the last thing I remember. And if I miss this, maybe it wasn't the same.
grief is a very private thing, but when you're a first lady, people look to you to help hold the country mm-hmm. together at a moment of tragedy.
Yes.
How did you decide what your public self was going to be like while you were falling apart emotionally, personally?
Since the revolution started while I was still young, in my 19th years old, I had to put all my emotions inside me. I have to always to be secured, not to show my feelings, not to show my affections in front of the people, so that I can set a good example for them. And that's what happened when I lost my husband. I couldn't even scream or cry in a loud voice because I ought not to do this, because I have to be very respectable. And I have also, as I am proud to represent the Egyptian people, I had my attitude must be very decent. And this is what I had to control myself and to put inside.
A few years after your husband was killed, you left Egypt for America. I know you now divide your time between Egypt and America. Were you angry with your country? Is that part of the reason why you left?
I can't say angry with my country because I love Egypt. I love my country so much. I was bitter from some of the newspapers which were writing against my husband, against me, against my family, that I decided also not to answer them because what they wrote were lies, completely lies. I said, I don't like to go through these things. But as a human being, I was very hurt, and my children were hurt. And when I received the offer to come and teach here in the United States, I found it it's a change and a challenge, which I love to do.
You campaigned a great deal of time in Egypt for women's rights. And I think some of the issues in the American women's rights movement are pretty different than in Egypt. I mean, they boil down to the mm-hmm. same ideas, but the
yes.
laws
different.
The laws are different, different. Right? And I think some of the family issues are maybe different. Were you surprised at all by the women's movement in America or by women's behavior in America?
Well, I'm not surprised because I'm always for women, but I am against extremists, I would say. I always believe that it is not a battle against men. It's not a fight against them. Even it is not a desire to be better than men. But it is our right to be equal. So far we are doing the same job, the same qualification, then why don't we be paid the same salary? What hurts also, and what I couldn't understand, that here, even in the United States, that there is no equal pay for equal work, which I can never understand. In Egypt, we don't have this problem, but we have others.
You grew up in a home that was, well, you were raised in the Islamic tradition.
Yes.
But your mother was English.
Yes.
So she brought into the home a lot of Western traditions, including tea in the afternoon.
That's true.
Yes. Do you think that that Western part of your family contributed to your efforts for women's rights?
In a way, yes, I would say, because I was brought up in a very warm atmosphere. My mother loved my father. She left her country to come and live in Egypt. She was, although she didn't change her religion, she didn't change her, she didn't take even the Egyptian nationality. She was very devoted to her country. But in the same time, she shared with us fasting during Ramadan. She brought up as exactly and very Muslim children, like our father, like the society which we were brought up. But in the same time, the way she was visiting her friends, and her friends comes to our home with their husbands and mixed together, sitting together, that was an atmosphere which I didn't find it with so many of my friends, whom their mothers were behind, and they never mixed with their father's friends, and they were very conservative. And growing in this atmosphere having confidence in myself, and my mother saying to me about so many stories also in Britain which happened during the war. All these things, and my aunt's stories also about one of our pioneers, whom she was called Huda Sha'rawi. All these together with my also reading. I used to read when I was a young girl about also very famous women and men. I think all together helped me in what I was calling for.
I want to talk to you more about your work on behalf of women's rights, but we're going to take a short break first.
Okay.
My guest is Jihan Sadat, who has worked for women's rights in Egypt, and she is the widow of the late president of Egypt, Anwar Sadat. She's written an autobiography titled A Woman of Egypt. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jihan Sadat is my guest. You came from a middle-class background.
Yes.
And your husband was from a much poorer background.
Yes.
And he came from a small village.
Yes.
That was very traditional in its treatment of women. Did you have to do any consciousness raising when you were first married so that he would respect your views about what your role should be in the marriage and outside of the marriage?
At the beginning of, first of all, our marriage was a love story that we loved, both of us loved each other. And when there is love, there are miracles, I believe. He was shocked from my way of meeting his friends, for instance. If he has friends coming to our home, I greet them and I sit with them till he comes, or I ask them about their families. And then he is shocked and he comes and he sits, and then I leave them together. And then after his friend leaves, he tells me, why did you talk to him, Jan? You don't know him. I said, but Anwar, he is my host. I'm his host. He's my guest. And he was shocked at the beginning because he was, like all Middle East men, very conservative, especially when you know that he's coming from a village that his mother was not mixed with men and never met her husband's friends. He was very surprised with my attitude. He tried to stop me in a way or to let me not to do it, but it was my nature. And then later on, he understood me, and I don't think it was something in our marriage. Later on, he became knowing the way we lived.
Well, when he entered public life, did he ever try to draw the line
no.
for your behavior?
No. On the contrary. The first meeting with the diplomat in our country, when he took over, he... Not I stood beside him only, he put me in front of him to shake hands with the ambassadors and their wives. And that was a sign that all of them, without anyone talking, all the ambassadors and their wives knew that there is a new system of, that this president is giving such a respect to his wife, showing the respect and the relation that he has with his wife, that they, all of them, appreciated it.
He said to you several times that you were getting him into trouble by
yes.
being so outspoken.
Yes.
Is there an example of a time when you thought, well, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to anyways?
It happened so many times together that he used to tell me, Jihan, you are putting me in trouble. Why do you say this? Especially during Nasser's time, when I used to say whatever I feel. And he said, well, that's wrong. You ought not to say this. You have to know that you are a wife of the one of the revolutionists. Yes, Anwar, but this is wrong. Even because I love the revolution. I love we are the one to start it. But then I don't want anyone to hate. But you have to be criticized sometimes or from time to time. But he was saying, oh, you will bring me trouble by all your openness and all your what you feel you say.
Well, you mentioned Nasser. He had once said about you to Gaddafi, I think. Well,
yes.
Well, you could dismiss what she's saying because she's part British.
Yes, exactly. That day we were having dinner at Nasser's house, and Gaddafi's wife was complaining that he arrested her uncle and at the beginning of the revolution in Libya. And all of the people who were attending, of course, they were on the side of Gaddafi that he has to do this because to protect the revolution. But I don't know. I found myself saying, no, I am with his wife. That is wrong. And then all of them were, sorry, it's the opposite. All of them were with the wife, with his wife. And I said, well, Gaddafi is right because he was protecting the revolution. And that was against even what Nasser said. And then he looked to Gaddafi and he said that because of her mother is British. And then I answered him. I told him, Mr. President, we have one boy called Gawad Hosni whom they study his story in our primary schools, that he was half British. His mother was British. His father was Egyptian. And he was against the British occupation. He was imprisoned in Ismailiyah. And they tortured him during his prison, and he never told them that I am half British or my mother is British so that they will have sympathy towards him and release him. But he didn't say, and he was killed.
Was this a problem for you that people perceived you as not being fully Egyptian because your mother was English? Did people try to dismiss your efforts for women's rights because you weren't 100% Egyptian?
No, never I have this feeling. Never the Egyptian has this feeling towards me because I feel, although I am half British, but I was brought up in Egypt. I am completely Egyptian woman by my attitude, by my love to my country, by everything. We never felt this, neither the people nor me.
You went to many villages.
Yes.
To work for women's rights there. And what were some of the difficulties of talking to women who knew only a traditional lifestyle? What were some of the difficulties in talking to them about alternate ways of acting and feeling when this is the only way they knew?
But they are, as I said in my book, although they are illiterate women, but they are very intelligent. I tried to convince them with something, and they pick so quickly. For instance, I started the first project, welfare project, for raising the standard of women in the rural areas. It was with peasants, just giving them sewing machine, training them, and letting them earn money and raise their standard. I can't tell you how quickly they picked everything and how quickly they changed. And this is a very practical thing, not just talking to them, but a practical thing that you can see from time to time, which is not very long, the changes they went through.
Jihan Sadat is my guest. When your husband was at Camp David mm-hmm. with Menachem Begin and Jimmy Carter, he had packed his bags. He'd given up at some point, packed his bags, and before he was ready to walk out on the Camp David Accords, he called you up to tell you he was leaving.
Yes.
And you talked him into unpacking and staying a while
yes,
longer.
For a while.
What did you tell him?
Well, I remember that day, every day before that, I was calling him and asking him about what's going on, and nearly every day it was almost the same answer, and I was always ending my call with the same blessing and hoping that God will help in solving this problem, which they went to Camp David for. And that day when he called me and he told me, I'm leaving because I feel that we will not reach the solution this time. But he was never not believing that he will continue. He always believed, but there were certain times that he said, well, I think Prime Minister Begin is not ready this time. Let us postpone it another time when he will be more flexible. But I begged him. I begged him that day to stay. And I told him, Anwar, you are a very patient man. Why don't you wait another day, another 2 days and see? Maybe you will reach something. Maybe you will reach what you want. And he said, I don't think this time, Jihan, if there was any sign for this, I would rather stay, sure. I'm not. And he is very well known that he's a very patient man. And it happened after that few hours that he called me back and told me, you were right. We've reached at last a solution and I'm going through Morocco and meet me there. After that few weeks, we will go back to the United States to sign the peace treaty.
You have a political career of your own in Egypt. You had been elected to a council that basically oversaw all the village councils. Yes. And you tell the people who you work with that you hated to be called Mrs. President.
Yes.
Because it meant that it wasn't acknowledging your own political life.
Exactly.
And your own role in politics.
Yes.
Have there been any challenges for you in establishing your own identity and your own work since your husband was killed and you're going through life without that partner?
It's very hard for me to live without my partner. It's not that easy because we loved each other, we understood each other, we respected each other very much. We completed each other, I would say. It's very hard for me to live without him, but I always believe that the happiest people are the busiest. I keep myself as busy as possible, teaching, carrying on his mission for peace, feeling that I am pleasing his soul so much. If his soul is watching, he will be very proud of me, as he was during his life.
In reading your book, I was thinking about how young you were when you got married. You were 15, and he was just about twice your age.
Exactly, yes.
And he had been married once before in an arranged marriage that didn't work out. And I couldn't help but think if you would have had allowed one of your children or grandchildren to marry at such a young age. You had to work hard to get your parents to agree to it.
I was exceptional, maybe. That was something not usual even at that time. But although my children married also young, but I don't agree now. I feel that they have to be older than that and to continue. But in our situation, as a president of Egypt, as a Muslim leader, his daughters better to marry young so that no one can say any word that they knew someone or they saw them with a boy or anything just to hurt or to come near to my husband. Because of that, they married also young. But they have a very successful marriage and they love their husbands and they are very happy.
Jihan Sadat, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Jihan Sadat, and she's the widow of the slain Egyptian president Anwar Sadat. She's an active campaigner for women's rights and now lectures at several American universities. She divides her time between homes in Virginia and Egypt. She's written an autobiography which is titled A Woman of Egypt, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Ronnie Spector. In the 60s, she was a singer with one of the best-known girl groups, the Ronettes. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne are joining us again today for our weekly performance spot. They share their lives together as performers and as husband and wife. They also share a love of old popular songs. But today they're going to perform a new song written by Jane.
Here's a song I wrote a few years back that continues to be a favorite with our audiences, and some people say it makes them think of an old song. I guess they're maybe hearing echoes of the old-time parlor songs people used to sing. I think of it as a thoroughly modern song. I wrote it for those of us who are shy. In the garden of life, you can see quite a show. There are flowers of every description. Oh, the colors are wild, side by side as they grow. Oh, what a happy condition. Some grow gracefully tall, others tastefully small. Still they all fall within the design. Each in its own way, quite fine, magnificent how they combine. My little flower, come out, it is your hour. You may own it or not, you are all that you got. Don't be shy, let it show. Oh, you are lovelier by far than you know. Still you keep it inside, a secret you hide. Pretty, how do you grow? Within your solitary gloom, you hide your glow. With your lovely little self tucked away on a shelf, locked up tight in a room. Oh, don't be withered by regret. Come out and bloom. My shrinking vine. What you wish you were. Don't go back on who you are. The soul of you will shine just like a star. My little flower, come out, it is your hour. Break your bones, but words will bring you down. watch our critics talk and stare. They can't define you nor compare. Oh, never mind. They won't find your like anywhere, my little flower. Come out, it is your hour. You may own it or not, you are all that you got. Don't be shy, let it show.
Jane Voss and Hoyle Osborne's latest record is called Pullin' Through. It's on the Green Linnet label. You're listening to Fresh Air. Steve Lacy's development as a musician parallels the history of jazz. New Orleans musician Sidney Bechet attracted Lacy to the soprano saxophone and to the sound of traditional jazz. As Lacy got older, the music of Thelonious Monk, Cecil Taylor, and Gil Evans challenged him to bring his instrument into a more contemporary setting. Over 20 years ago, Lacy packed his soprano and moved to Europe. One reason was there just wasn't enough work in the States for a musician whose instrument was not frequently heard in modern jazz. Lacy has returned for a brief performance tour. I spoke with him from New York, and he told me what he finds special about the soprano saxophone.
First of all, the range is higher, and like a trumpet, really. It has something to do with the trumpet, something to do with the flute, something to do with the right hand of a piano. It's the treble. It's the right hand. It's the melodic part, really, and that part is very attractive. It's just difficult technically. That's all.
When you started playing modern jazz and then avant-garde music, there were virtually no other soprano players. You were playing modern jazz before Coltrane picked up the soprano. Did you have to figure out how to use the instrument in a modern setting?
Absolutely. I had to invent everything. The whole thing had to be done from zero because there were no models, there were no guides, there was no books, there was no teachers, there was nothing. I had to do it myself.
When John Coltrane started playing soprano saxophone, did you see him as either detracting from your uniqueness or as keeping you company?
Yeah, more like company. He was really welcome. I was glad to. It was a surprise when he first took it up in 1960, but a few weeks later we were working in the same club. I was working with Monk, and he had his first quartet in the old jazz gallery, and there we were, the both of us, playing the soprano in the same club every night. So that was the beginning, really.
Did you ever sit down with him and talk to him about the soprano?
Well, sure, yeah, before he got one. I mean, he came up to me and asked me what key it's in, really. And I told him it was B-flat, and he was very surprised. He didn't know that. It seemed like he was looking for something. He was looking for a way up from the tenor. And he didn't know how to split the tenor into a higher and a lower part, and the soprano was what he had been looking for.
Early on, when you started to play, you were playing an updated form of traditional jazz. I think frequently young musicians want to be very current. And I wonder what led you back towards a more historical form of jazz when you started to play.
Really, New Orleans and Kansas City, these were the styles I really liked, the early music. But I always had a certain progressive appetite, a tendency, and it was really Cecil who opened my ears to the more modern music, really.
Did you ever feel cut off from musicians of your generation in those early years?
Not until Cecil came up to me and said, "Why are you, a young musician, playing such old music?" That was a startling question. That was the first time I ever started to think about that.
And it was that comment that led you to venture into modern music?
Well, not that simple, but that was the opening of my friendship with Cecil, and he was the one that really took me by the hand and showed me what was happening.
You spent several years dedicating yourself to performing music written by Thelonious Monk. It makes me think that you were playing Monk's music as if it had become a discipline for you.
Well, I was looking for some music that would fit my instrument. There was nothing. And when I found Monk's music, it fit. It fit me and it fit the instrument to a T. So that was very important. Then the work began for me of how to play it on my instrument, how to make it sound good, how to learn all those pieces. But, of course, it was a school for me. It was my models of composition and for performing. And I studied that music for many years. I'm still working on it. But it was very important for me, for my instrument, and for my conception as a composer and as a player.
Monk heard you and asked you to play with him, and you played with his group for a while. Did you see his music differently once you started actually playing with
him? Of course, yeah. And he showed me many things, and he showed me what not to do, really. I had been barking up the wrong tree here and there, and he would correct me. And that was a big help to me. He gave me many little tips and told me what not to do, usually, and that was a big help. I needed that.
What's an example of something he told you not to do?
Well, don't play the piano part. I used to play the melody, and I tried to play the piano part, too, on the saxophone. I was so enthusiastic. But that was redundant, really. And he told me, look, don't play the piano part. I'm playing the piano part. I'm accompanying you. Don't accompany me. So that straightened me out right there. But there were 100 little things like that he told me.
What's another one?
Another one, he says, well, don't play all those strange notes just to be, I mean, really play the melody and swing, pat your foot and sing the melody and play off the melody. Don't just play strange notes just because they're interesting. It's not interesting.
That's interesting that someone as eccentric as Monk would say, don't be strange just for the sake of being strange.
There was nothing eccentric about his music, really. It was genial. I mean, it was a long scientific process that led him to explore the possibilities of the piano and to write those pieces. There's nothing eccentric about them. They're very, very brilliantly made.
Well, your music started becoming more and more modern. You went from Monk to the avant-garde. You started doing a lot of free improvisation.
Well, these things were going on simultaneously. I was still working with some of the older players, but I was working with Cecil also and some of my own groups. And in some experimental groups, there were... In New York back in the 50s, it was possible a certain mobility, and you could go between the different styles and different types of group all at the same time.
You spent some time doing a lot of free improvisation, which had no compositional structure that it departed from. Can you compare the pleasures for you as a player in improvising on something that's composed and just free improvising?
That's a good question. Well, free improvisation can be fun, really. It can be stimulating, can be very interesting. But as whether to produce it in public for public consumption, that's another question. And it depends on your appetites, really. I feel like a composer, really. And what I do is partially prepared and partially unprepared. So I like to do a mixture and an improvisation which is free within certain limits. But I also can do completely free improvisation, but I think it's more difficult to present that in public, that's all.
It seems to me that during your life, you've always, for one reason or another, been not at the center of the scene. Let me explain what I mean. When you were young, you were playing early jazz at a time when most of your peers were probably playing modern jazz. And then you played the soprano saxophone, an instrument that wasn't really welcomed into the heart of jazz for a while. There wasn't that much call for it for a while. And then you started playing very avant-garde music, also somewhat on the periphery. And then you moved out of New York altogether, moved away from the capital of jazz. I get the impression that you've almost, in a way, consciously or unconsciously, avoided really being at the center of things.
Well, you have a point there. That the word periphery is important. I think that if you're right in the center of things, it's especially in New York, you know, there's so many great musicians here and so much going on that it's hard to hew to an independent line here. You can't maintain a group here, and you can't maintain a separate station here because it's too mixed up. There's too much going on. So if you're making music and there's a music all around you, there's no, you know, music for me has to come from silence, from space, from emptiness, really. And if there's no emptiness, if there's no tranquility around what you do, then it's very hard to concentrate. It's hard to produce that, really. I need a certain space around me.
Steve Lacy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Steve Lacy has two new records, Only Monk and Sempre Amore, both on the Soul Note record label. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who's co-hosting the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up on the show today?
A lot more information on the Philippines. A day after a bloody coup attempt in Manila, we have U.S. reaction, a little more information from the scene, and a broad look at the future of the Aquino government. Also, in Louisiana, the chemical industry and pollution, a very politically sensitive issue, and problems with the chemical industry in that state, and a look at the very incredible productive life of movie director John Huston, who died today.
He was working on a film.
Right up until the end, working and responsible for such classics as The Maltese Falcon, Pritzi's Honor most recently, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, African Queen. I could go on.
Oh, thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When you get married, you're not only getting a mate for life, you're also getting their record collection. Humorist Alfred Gingold tells us what he discovered when he and his wife reorganized their joint record collection.
My wife's desire to organize our joint record collection increased recently to the level of non-negotiable demand. Now, I have always felt that there is only one proper way to store records, randomly. There are limitations inherent in this method, of course. My Christmas carols, for example, turn up only during Easter week. During Christmas, I think they dematerialize. So, I grudgingly agreed to my wife's wish, despite my conviction that people who organize their records are the same people who tell you it isn't really the heat, it's the humidity. When everybody knows damn well, it's the heat. So, how do we do this? I asked. Well, let's classify them by types, and then alphabetize by section, she replied. Fine, I said. There's rock, there's classical, there's jazz, there's blues, country, folk, spoken word dramatic, spoken word comic, folk rock, rhythm and blues, reggae, funk, punk. Maybe we can condense some of these. Country is sort of like folk, so maybe they can go together. Well, so is blues, but it's also sort of like jazz. So which? We'll decide later, she said. First, let's alphabetize the big sections. Let's see. There's pistols, sex, Dead, Grateful. I said, Quartet, Modern Jazz, Symphony, Ninth. Hey, where do we put Booker T and the MGs? But these logistical horrors were nothing compared to some of the embarrassing revelations of musical taste which emerged. I didn't know that you had the complete works of Roxy Music, I said. Something wrong with that, she snapped. Did I say there was? For that matter, she said, you never told me you had Neil Sedaka's comeback album. It was a gift. I had nothing to do with it. No doubt. But what about your Eric Satie problem? What's wrong with Eric Satie? 6 Eric Satie albums is a problem. And I'm not even mentioning your Livingston Taylor archive, or your Jose Feliciano trove, or... She was going on as I left the room and slammed the door behind me. But in the end, we kissed and made up. I agreed not to say anything about her Dr. Hook collection if she would lay off me about Jimmy Buffett. We had some laughs, too. It's been a long time since I listened to the score of the Vikings, not to mention my old touch type lessons. And of course, we found some common ground. 15 John Coltranes, 3 copies of Vivaldi's 4 Seasons, now the 12 Seasons around our place, and 31 Rolling Stones albums, almost all of them duplicates. No wonder they've always been easy to find. An element of bohemian raffishness has gone out of my life, but at least now, if I want to hear a little, say, Exile on Main Street, I know just where to look, under the S's, for Stones, Rolling.
Alfred Gingold lives and writes in Brooklyn, New York. His books include Items from Our Catalog, a spoof of the L.L. Bean catalog, and Snooze, The Best of Our Magazine, a parody of The New Yorker. Here's a look ahead to the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with soprano Benita Valente, one of the foremost interpreters of Lieder, oratorio, and opera. She's long been a favorite of critics and is now gaining popular acclaim. Jazz critic Francis Davis will review the new album by Canadian guitarist Sonny Greenwich, and TV critic David Bianculli will preview an Alive from Off-Center production featuring Meredith Monk in a staging of Ellis Island. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.